Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, I'm Orlando Crowcroft, World Editor at IB Times UK. Welcome back to In the Field, a podcast where each week we speak to correspondents and stringers, aid workers and analysts across the globe, reporting and working on the stories that matter. This week we're taking a look at Iraq and speaking to our very own Callum Patton, a senior foreign reporter at IB Times UK, who recently spent 10 days in the southern cities of Karbala and Najaf and the capital of Baghdad. During his time in Iraq, Callum visited the families of fighters killed during Iraq's war against ISIS, and we learned about the efforts to heal the divide between Iraq's Sunni and Shia population. We're also speaking to John Reynolds, a freelance journalist, about his research into issues of corruption in southern Iraq, and particularly in Basra. It was concerns about corruption that brought thousands of Iraqis onto the streets in Baghdad in May 2016 and, John explains, could bring them out again this summer.
So we're speaking to Callum Patton. He's a senior foreign reporter at IB Times. He is currently in Karbala. He's been in Iraq for about a week. Callum, tell us a little bit about what's going on where you are. I know that the areas you're in are predominantly Shia areas, so they're perhaps a little safer than up north in Mosul. But of course, there's also been a lot of challenges. So, what's going on really in the part of Iraq that you're in at the moment?
Yeah, so like you've said, I'm in Karbala, which is kind of, I guess, part of the Shia heartlands in the south of the country. So, this city, Najaf, and Kufa, all of which are in the south and have kind of majority Shia populations, weren't at any point overrun by Islamic State and haven't seen a great deal of the fighting between 2014 to now. But by nature of the fact that they are, Najaf is the Shia population's capital in Iraq. All of these places have shrines and other holy places. So and they have a lot of pilgrims coming in and out, not just from Iraq, but also from Iran. So these people are also targets for the Islamic State. So while there hasn't been conventional fighting as such, there have been fairly frequent suicide bomb attacks targeting the civilian populations here and trying to brew more of that sectarian violence and drive a wedge between the Shia and Sunni populations wherever they can.
And it's an interesting year that you're there because, of course, it's been 10 years now since the worst of the kind of Shia-Sunni sectarian fighting. I mean, how fresh is that in people's memories, particularly given the kind of anti-Shia rhetoric of ISIS?
Going back to the 2006 sectarian war and also the 2003 U.S. coalition invasion, that's when there was a lot of violence and fighting here. Muqtadir al-Sadr's Jaish al-Madani was very, very active in and around here. It's the Shia fighters who supported him are many of them are drawn from these Shia heartlands. So while in this kind of most recent round of violence around the Islamic State, well, that's mostly been in the north and in the Sunni triangle. The sectarian violence and the memories of fighting in Karbala and Najaf are kind of, you know, are very much there. All of the Iraqis that you speak to, you get a real sense of how much they've been through, not just over the last 10 years, but the last 15 years, and what an impression that's made on the whole community. And then even before 2003, you have the Shia uprisings in 1991, which were kind of part and parcel of the Gulf War. So these are the communities that really felt that they were abandoned by the United States. Because they were expecting help in overthrowing Saddam, and then they were punished for that. So this is kind of fight against Islamic State, which Iraqi authorities are trying their very best to show in the least sectarian terms as they can, is still part and parcel of a long history of this kind of violence.
I mean, I was interested, your recent piece for us from Samara was very interesting on a lot of levels. But I mean, the character of the gravedigger, I think you met, when he'd actually been up and fought against ISIS. So I suppose a lot of the Shia are kind of doing their times with the militias and going up, fighting, and then coming back.
So that's the labourer who was
from
Basra.
Yeah.
What has surprised me is the number of people that you speak to who, particularly in, I guess, late 2014, when Islamic State was really almost knocking on the door of Baghdad, how many people went and fought. And I think this has everything to do with the fatwa that Ayatollah Sistani gave in 2014, when for the first time the highest Shia authority in Iraq asked people to go and fight against Islamic State. And he said, your first priority above anything else is to go and fight for the homeland. So, you know, this is Iraq, where a lot of people have been involved in a lot of, you know, really gritty fighting for a long time. But in 2014, you have people who have never picked up a gun before going and fighting against Islamic State. And the religious aspect of this and the importance of the fatwa on the faith, I think, is also, you see this because I've spoken to two imams who also, when this fatwa was made, went and fought as well. So everyone felt that they needed to go and do this, and that no one was going to be left out. So also kind of presents some challenges for the country when suddenly you have so much of the population that has been involved in fighting and is aligned even in a casual way with some sort of armed formation or armed militia.
Yeah, but the interesting thing was that the same guy, the labourer, he at the end of your piece, he said how he didn't have a sectarian attitude towards it. And that's something I think that people will be really looking forward to when ISIS is, you know, eventually pushed out. Will this kind of, the fact that many Shias have gone to fight in Sunni areas, will this lead to even more division in Iraq?
So, I mean, people here now at the moment are really saying, and this is, I think a lot of national pride was lost in 2014 when ISIS was able to take over so much of the country so quickly and so easily, and you saw the Iraqi army just sort of fading into the desert and running away. And now, after kind of a string of victories across the country, and I mean everyone is kind of waiting for Mosul to fall. I know that the offensive has stalled, but I think that it really gave people a lot of their pride back. And at the moment, with a kind of common enemy, which is something that I've seen in other countries with this kind of conflict, with a common enemy, it is true that Shias are fighting alongside Sunnis and alongside Christians, and that at the moment these guys are happy to fight in brigades where they have flags and which have Shia iconography on them, and also the sectarian divisions in Iraq have not always been as bad as they were certainly in 2006, and things that maybe you wouldn't see every day. I mean, there's lots of intermarriage between Shias and Sunnis. So on a normal everyday level, there isn't the baying for blood that you might see reported in the press. But I think at the moment they have a common enemy that's united them, and it will be interesting to see how these now very powerful Shia militias what role they play, how they're used, and whether maybe not 2 months after Mosul falls, but a year and a half, when there hasn't been the reconstruction that people are expecting, things aren't going as well as you might have expected before. It's how you heal those rifts and divisions. And there's also a lot of tribal violence, particularly in Saladin and Anbar province now that they've been liberated.
Right.
Because some tribes are seeing as having supported the Islamic State or as being collaborators. I was in an internally displaced people's camp, and there are refugees there from towns like Ramadi and Fallujah, who are unable to return home. Not because, and you know, they left 2 years ago, so they obviously weren't collaborating with the Islamic State, but because they are from a tribe which has been accused of helping ISIS, they can't go back to where they're from for fear of reprisal. So there's a whole Pandora's box of challenges for Iraq after Islamic State is defeated. And while the fighting's going on in the north, in Baghdad particularly, those are things that they're trying to get a handle on.
And talk to us a little bit about, I mean, how does cities like Baghdad, Karbala, how does it feel to be there? I mean, is there a heavy security presence? Do you really feel like, you know, these are cities under siege, or are they relatively, you know, free to move around and so on?
So Karbala and Najaf, I would say the security presence is pretty minimal. There are a lot of checkpoints, particularly on the roads, outside any kind of Shia mosque or any kind of government building. There are obviously checkpoints, and there's an armed presence. Baghdad is relatively easy to get around in. Getting in and out of the green zone it takes a very long time, but I would think, you know, this is my first time coming here, but I would think that that's been the case since it was established.
Yeah.
What the difference is in Baghdad, although the atmosphere is very, very light in Baghdad. I wouldn't say that it feels oppressive or like a city that's on lockdown by any stretch of the imagination. But what you do have there is anywhere where there are going to be large crowds of people gathered are very, very extensive checkpoints where police are looking for suicide bombers. So not always long queues, but people are patted down and checked whenever they go in to make sure that there's nothing that's hanging around their middle when they go into these places.
And in given that, and on from a personal point of view, is it difficult to work as a journalist in a place like that? With, I mean, can you just walk around and get the stories you want to get, or do you need to be very careful?
I think with all of these things, I imagine people have their different reporters have their different limits, and they're weighing up different situations when they come across them. And someone who has been here for longer than a week would definitely be able to answer that question better. I was only in Baghdad for 3 or 4 days, and the whole time I was with a delegation, and we had fixers and security people who were making these decisions. But I don't. But I think if you have a meeting in Baghdad, if you want to go and talk to some normal people in certain areas, I didn't see too many limitations in that sense. I think the nature of the threat is at some point, at some time, and government officials that we've spoken to have said, look, this isn't going to stop anytime soon. A suicide bomb is going to go off, and there's not too much planning. It's not like there are kind of clashes erupting in the city, and suddenly you find yourself, you know, stuck in one district or unable to travel down one road. That isn't the way that things go here. And also, we've not been close to anywhere where there's been any sort of explosion and an attack. From what people have said, this is now such a kind of such a fact of daily life, unfortunately, that things do return to normal relatively quickly after something like that happens.
Yeah. And I guess finally, I mean, what's the perception of amongst Iraqis of the West and how the West is responding to ISIS? And even in your kind of one-on-one conversations with people as a foreign reporter,
I actually don't find Iraqis talking about the West that often. I don't know if that's because obviously I'm a Westerner, and they know, and they don't want to disagree with me. That wouldn't be a problem for me. What I hear the most, and this maybe speaks to the influence of of regional powers in the country, and also where I am in Shia areas, there is some small criticism of Iran.
Right.
Although the country is broadly seen as being, I've been told that it was the first country to arm the popular mobilization forces. And this is seen as Iran coming to the aid of the Iraqi people before anyone else did. These are the terms that it's been described to me in. What the real criticism is for Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, and particularly Saudi Arabia, they really see Islamic State as being influenced, funded, and backed by Saudi and the Wahhabist ideology and, yeah, and doctrine that that the Saudi madrasas espouses as being really a driving factor in the expansion of Islamic State in Iraq.
Thanks, Callum. Fascinating talking to you.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Thanks for speaking to me, Orlando.
Thanks for that, Callum. And now over to John. Okay, so I'm with John Reynolds. John is a journalist working on the issue of corruption in Iraq. He was last in Baghdad in 2012 and in Basra in 2011, but since then has been in Jordan and has met a lot of Iraqi expatriates and is in daily contact with them, people on the ground, over WhatsApp and various other media. Welcome, John.
Hi.
We're really interested. Obviously, we've just spoken to Callum, our reporter, who was in southern Iraq at the end of last year. And I'm really interested in kind of the dynamics there. Of course, everybody's talking about the north, about the war against ISIS, and perhaps that has clouded or obscured the fact that there's still really serious problems on the ground in the south. We saw protests last year in 2016, and they were mainly against the issues of corruption and so on. So, I mean, when you talk to your contacts out there, what are their major complaints?
When you're looking at the south, a number of issues that have kind of come onto my radar. The first is a kind of a proliferation, if you like, of criminal gangs in and around Basra who are involved in kidnapping and kind of extortion. There's been a big problem as well, which is something else I've looked into, in smuggling in of either fake or counterfeit medicines, and that obviously goes on to have repercussions for the health service and people's health. And I think that's in and around Basra, I think that's probably one of the main concerns. And then, you know, aside from that is just probably the wider kind of political stagnancy. Also in Basra, there's a kind of a continued debate around whether Basra might at some stage have some sort of independence to be able to have more control over its own affairs, because at the moment, in terms of its public services, you know, it's always having to request money from the government in Baghdad and from the ministries there, you know, for money for basic resources, you know, education, health again, and what have you. So I think they would be the main concerns there.
Well, that's interesting, because of course they're almost exactly the same demands that the Kurds have had in the north for that kind of independence from Baghdad. And it's interesting, of course, that Basra is a wealthy province, as is the Kurdish north. So it's almost like everybody wants to get away from this Baghdad kind of machine.
This is true. I think they kind of, you know, whether they're kind of looking at it from the point of view is that the grass is always greener, I don't know. But as you say, given that the majority of the oil wealth is centered in the south, there seems to be a hope, you know, that if they were to have some sort of independence and more control over their affairs, you know, they would have perhaps kind of looser reins and to be able to use that money more, you know, more productively. But at the same time, there again, you know, you've also got the kind of the wider endemic corruption, and so how those two things would quite go together, you know, there hasn't really been any kind of vision or anything like that explained by anyone, I think, to the Iraqi people themselves. And I think the current governor in Baghdad, in Basra, started out, you know, I think having quite optimistic and quite noble aims. But there again, I think if you look on the ground and talk to people about their kind of daily experiences, he's been there, I think, a number of years now. And, you know, the results that he's managed to achieve are not too great, going by what my contacts tell me.
So when you're talking to people on the ground there, when we look at it here from the UK on the news, we tend to think about security and imagine that security is the major thing that people worry about in Iraq, that people want an end to terrorism and so on. But would you say that from the people you're talking to, actually, perhaps even more than that is concerns about corruption?
I think, as you say, because of what's happened here in Europe and what have you and across the world, I think we look at Iraq through the kind of the lens of, you know, security and ISIS, and, you know, obviously for people living there, you know, their daily lives for them, you know, it's the horrific state of the public services, you know, under-resourced, underfunded, understaffed, and then, you know, their anger about that, you know, is directed at the political corruption, because, you know, they can see, and again, we don't see this because it's in Arabic, but on their kind of weekly and even nightly sometimes, you know, the equivalent of the Iraqi kind of news nights or, you know, current affairs programs, you know, they do still try to uncover and report on political corruption there. Unfortunately, you know, it's becoming a lot more sensitive as well, because obviously the politicians in power there, they want as little of this reported as possible, obviously, and they don't want issues brought to light which might, you know, bring people out on the streets again, as they have been, you know, last year and the year before.
Have people mentioned specifically the protests that we saw in, I think it was May 2016 in the Green Zone, that kind of made the news even here? Have people mentioned those, and was there a sense that we should expect more?
I think so, yeah. You can just tell, you know, from speaking to people and their daily experiences, you know, during summer in Iraq, you know, the frustration and the anger seems to build up in conjunction with the rising temperature, you know, the rising sort of physical temperature, you know, some observers say, and I wouldn't be surprised, you know, given that there hasn't been really any change in the situation, or if anything, you know, possibly things have worsened for people in their daily lives. I think we should definitely probably expect the same thing again, you know, at some point during this summer.
It's interesting because Haider al-Abadi seemed to come when he was elected and he took over after Nour al-Maliki, who was, you know, kind of renowned for corruption. Abadi tended to give this impression that there was kind of a new dawn for Iraq, and yet it doesn't seem to have turned out like that.
No, it's, again, with Iraq, you know, you look at what's going on the surface, and then the deeper you delve and the more people you talk to, you know, the more you realize that a lot really hasn't changed from, you know, from talking to some senior analysts and observers, you know, that I've been speaking to in my work. Maliki is still there in the background. He's still pulling various strings. Ministries and their staff are still doing his bidding. And when, you know, whenever Maliki is talked about, inevitably what will arise in the conversation is the question of Iran and his closeness to Iran and the effect that that has on kind of the direction of affairs as well. So again, that's another kind of optic, if you like, you have to introduce into the picture when you're looking at Iraq, and you know it makes it a very complex complex subject and place to look at and really try to understand.
Yeah, I mean, that was going to be my kind of concluding question was going to be, I mean, Basra is very much in the Iranian sphere of influence. Do people feel that acutely on the street? I mean, is there more Iranian presence in the south of Iraq, and does it feel like they are, you know, maybe expanding their influence there?
I think, yes, I think with the, you know, just physically, you know, geographically, they're closer to Iran and the south, and obviously being Shia dominated as well, that is part of the mindset. It's difficult to understand how, you know, how much influence that is having over affairs in the south. For example, in relation to kind of Basra and its, you know, its governorship and control. I myself in my work and my research, you know, I haven't really been able to understand how much that is occurring in the south. But it's, you know, I mean, if it's taking place in Baghdad, where you know, where Maliki still also seems to exercise his influence at some level, he must, you know, he must have people in the south as well that are doing his bidding to some extent. I know he did. There was reports that he did visit Basra, I think in the last month or so. I think from what I understood, he didn't, you know, he didn't perhaps get such a great welcome. But you know, that wouldn't, you know, that really wouldn't kind of do anything, not to suggest, you know, that he still has some influence there through other means. You know, just kind of under the surface, as it were.
So that's the situation on the ground in Iraq at the moment. We've included rich links to Callum's reports from Karbala, Najaf and Baghdad in this podcast, so if you're listening on Acast, please be sure to go back and check them out. There's plenty more pieces on the war in Iraq on the website as well. So for more information, go to ibtimes.co.uk. Lastly, if you like this podcast, please subscribe on iTunes and leave us a review. Next week, we're heading back to the States, looking at the inauguration of Donald Trump. Until then, take care.
Up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both as twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in...
opinions.
We do that in every episode, too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.